today. As the former Chancellor, Philip Hammond, warns that the government is headed to a no-deal Brexit, we go inside the Treasury with his former special advisor. And how a journalist uncovered the lengths one company was willing to go to discredit her work. Parliament is gearing up for an autumn showdown over a no-deal Brexit. Philip Hammond, until recently Chancellor of the Exchequer, has accused Boris Johnson of shutting down any hope of securing an agreement.
Well, leaving the EU without a deal would be just as much a betrayal of the referendum result as not leaving at all.
After all, voters had been told...
The free trade agreement that we will have to come to with the European Union should be one of the easiest in human history.
But with the Downing Street mantra of Brexit, do or die...
She said Brexit means Brexit. He says do or die.
Do or die.
Do or die.
Come on, man. Do or die. Come on, man.
And by any means necessary, no deal is looking much more likely, with bookies this week cutting the odds. Not to Boris Johnson's prediction...
I think it's a million to one against.
But to virtually 50-50, or the toss of a coin. It's been quite a journey for the Treasury, which first warned against any Brexit at all, but is now having to prepare for the economic impact of no deal. From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, from Project Fear to Do or Die, how the Treasury was forced to get on board with Brexit. It's one of the grandest offices of state with a fearsome reputation. Britain's Treasury rises up out of Whitehall and provides a cockpit for the British economy. It is in this building that hundreds of civil servants work to carry out the economic policies of the government of the day, whether it's raising taxes, setting budgets, carefully managing the country's accounts, or preparing for the biggest potential shock of all, a no-deal Brexit.
It's quite a closed-off space, very imposing, and once you step inside, you sort of feel like that's it for the day.
Poppy Trowbridge was special advisor to Chancellor Philip Hammond.
And then you kind of emerge into the blinking evening light after 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 hours, whatever it is.
How often was it 11 or 12?
Oh, it was 15 or 16 most of the time. We used to lament the passing of the seasons in St. James's Park, which is just opposite. And it was beautiful to watch spring and summer and autumn come and the light change. And we'd only catch glimpses of it as we scurried between number 10 and 11.
Just give me a flavour of what life was like for you. How frantic did it get?
Obviously, as Brexit got more and more intense, things got busier and busier and busier. While these Brexit negotiations were going on, so you couldn't have a bath on a Sunday morning without the Brexit secretary ringing you.
What, literally ringing you in the bath?
Well, I didn't tell him I was in the bath.
He couldn't hear you splashing around?
No, I sat very still.
You arrived at the Treasury as a special advisor in the summer of 2016, just after that incredibly tense and divisive and bitterly fought referendum. I feel like the Treasury is one of the key characters in the story of Brexit. It has a stake at every step, and it had a huge stake in that referendum. It was the organisation that fronted up all the warnings that were later described as Project Fear.
The central conclusions of today's Treasury analysis are clear. A vote to leave will push our economy into a recession. Within 2 years, the size of our economy, our
a
GDP,
direct consequence of a vote to leave the EU would be significant job losses.
420,000
jobs could be lost.
We'd have a year of negative
growth. And for those
growth,
that stay in work, wages will be.
The Treasury analysis finds
the borrowing bill for leaving the EU.
House prices would be.
If we vote to leave, the evidence shows that the deficit would be higher than it would be if we remain.
A vote to leave will push our economy into a recession.
What did you find when you arrived?
Well, funnily, it wasn't that was the overriding sense. It was the sadness at the loss of George Osborne, who had been there for such a long time and was very integrated. He knew a lot of people and he'd often walk the floors. And
I loved him.
They loved him. And of course, under him, the Treasury was very politically powerful as well. And there was a sense that this administration was going to take things in a different way, both from the Prime Minister, but also from the new Chancellor, who was less political. And my overriding memory of those first few weeks was of a place mourning the loss of a guy they knew really well.
Theresa May chose Philip Hammond for number 11.
Congratulations to you, but it's
Thank
a tough
Adam.
Job at a tough time, isn't it?
Well, the economy has taken a shock. The markets, businesses, consumers were not expecting the Brexit decision. We will take whatever measures are necessary to restore confidence, stabilise the economy as we move forward.
I assume because they'd known each other for years and he was seen as competent, as a safe pair of hands. He got this nickname, Spreadsheet Phil. Was that fair?
Utterly. It was a marvel to behold in those first few months when officials would come in and unfurl the scorecard, which probably has 4,000 numbers on it. And within seconds, he could identify if there was a missing plus or minus or if something didn't quite add up. It was incredible. And I think that was the beginning of how he established his positive relationship with the Treasury. He wasn't maybe operating in the political way George Osborne was, but he genuinely understood the work. He read it all. He was very good at the figures. And I remember in one meeting, in fact, I think it probably was that first budget, where the civil servant came in and said, "Well, as you know, Chancellor, we used to hide money from George Osborne. We don't dare do that with you."
Despite having put out all these dire warnings about what could happen if the country voted leave, the Treasury was now in charge of ensuring that the damage to the economy was as little as possible. Did they believe the figures they had put out? And at that point, did they think this Brexit puzzle was solvable?
I genuinely believe that they thought they had done the right sums, but it's very simple. They were measuring the absence of a relationship in trade that we had. That it's easy to measure the absence of something that is on the table in front of you. What they couldn't, of course, measure, which they admitted to, was the potential gains in time when new trading relationships, for example, were established. I suppose, in retrospect, acknowledging the scope or limited scope of their assessment might have gone some way to reassuring those that really disagreed with that analysis. I still feel that the sums are the sums. I mean, maths don't lie.
So the Treasury did the numbers right, but maybe the way they were communicated.
They did the numbers right, but they were only a portion of the numbers, and the way they were communicated did scare people.
By this point, the referendum is long behind you, and all your energy is focused on trying to get a Brexit deal.
Tonight at 10, jobs and prosperity must come first in any Brexit deal. The Chancellor spells out his priorities, which are seen as a signal that he wants a change of emphasis in the Brexit process.
Although that parliamentary landscape was looking increasingly difficult, whichever way you go, people to the left, people to the right who were causing you potential trouble, even if you did get a deal. From internal government information at the time, were you able to start to build up a picture of what no deal might look like?
I'm not sure what you mean by internal government information that that you'd expect me to discuss on a podcast, but absolutely departments had started to bring in ideas of what they thought they needed. And we were in constant contact with businesses and with other Whitehall departments about, in some cases, the concerns businesses had about what would happen and departments about what they thought they needed to do to prepare. And remember, any Treasury person would say this, but it is fundamentally true. It is not just about handing out cash. If there aren't people trained up in border control, it doesn't matter how much money you have, they don't exist to hire. So many of the early issues were around supply of people and machinery and, you know, IT systems that we would need, and less about the actual money, but more about what could be supplied in time.
Do you remember the first time Theresa May said no deal is better than a bad deal?
Well, first of all, what I have said is that no deal would be better than a bad deal. No deal for Britain is better than a bad deal for Britain.
No, I don't. She said it so many times, it's very hard to remember when you first heard it.
Yes, I've said before, I've said on many occasions that no deal is better than a bad deal.
I have always said in the very beginning, no deal is better than a bad deal.
Do you know what you thought of it?
From a Treasury perspective, it wasn't ideal. as a political appointee, I understood what she was trying to do in saying that. But yes, there were times we felt she said it at the wrong time and too often.
But did you take it seriously? Were you putting money aside? Because your critics weren't convinced.
Brexit allocations were made up to $6 billion by the time I left the job. But this, I always felt, was one of the mistakes people made when demanding, and I'm referring to sort of politicians demanding that Treasury do more to put money aside for no deal prep. The Treasury did put money aside, billions aside for no deal prep. The work had to be done to find out what preparations were required. Was it more border guards? Was it more accountants? What was it, and how would it be done? And that work took a long time to get underway because, of course, it was an unprecedented situation. So that was work that needed to be done in departments. Then you come to the Treasury with an estimate of what it's going to cost and you get the money for it. I refute this idea that Treasury was trying to sabotage no deal prep. It was a difficult exercise, and many departments struggled to get rolling with the types of things that they needed to propose to the Treasury for funding.
The very idea of no deal is quite a difficult concept to get your head around. What were the factors that you had to consider?
There were issues around services and reciprocal services. There were issues around food supply, because, of course, that depends on the porousness of your borders. And if the borders were to become more controlled, the amount of food, medicine, all that sort of thing that would be able to get in had to be factored in. And often the problems weren't the type of thing that you'd expect. So when you talk about stricter border control, you think, well, that means there'll be fruit rotting in lorries coming into the UK. That was an allegation made often in the press.
A no-deal Brexit would be a disastrous outcome for Britain's food sector if delays at ports leave fresh produce rotting in lorries.
But it's just as much a problem that empty trucks are stuck in the UK and can't get back. And so what happens is the supply chain starts to break down. I would say that the first phase of no-deal planning was often about the logistics.
Were there departments that were much more exposed than others?
Of course, certain departments were more exposed than others. The Department for Food and Rural Affairs, the Home Office responsible for border security. But there wasn't a sense at all that anybody could relax for a minute. Everyone was going through absolutely everything they had to make sure that they were across any potential impacts to the industries that they were responsible for. And of course, Treasury was responsible for financial services. And Philip Hammond worked very hard to make sure they were represented.
Were people coming in all the time to talk to you, to update you, to tell you about their fears, people that we didn't necessarily hear about?
The food industry was very concerned about what it would mean for delayed deliveries and border control, that sort of thing. But it didn't necessarily speak publicly. I suspect it was because they were worried about frightening their customers.
How worried were you about it from where you were sitting?
I genuinely believed we would end up with a deal. I was obviously on the team working for a deal. And that, for me, was my hope, and it still is my hope.
You're preparing for the eventuality of no deal, but at the same time, inside the Treasury, people must have been very nervous about that outcome. After all the controversy around so-called Project Fear, were officials worried about putting forward their worst-case scenarios?
I think you've touched on something that after the backlash, there was certainly some reticence about, and I can speak specifically from my experience. I was comms director there. And of course, you knew that you would get backlash if a figure was presented in a way as to appear threatening or frightening, a figure we might have just looked at as a plain fact. But I think it was also my job to take account of the feelings of people on both sides of the argument and to find a way to reach out to both groups. You cannot underestimate the feeling on behalf of some people that the democratic vote to leave would not be respected. And so backlash from that corner stemmed from a sense of genuine fear. And I think that has to be recognised.
And the backlash was pretty strong.
Yep.
What I'm talking about is the way the Treasury has behaved both before and after the referendum. If you look at the forecasts the Treasury made before the referendum, they were a humiliation.
And they may have been wrong, but that is different, Mr. Rees-Mogg, from claiming they were rigged.
They were clearly politically influenced. So, yes, I do think they're fiddling the figures.
I mean, tell me about the attacks against the Treasury during this period.
Well, the Treasury is pretty robust. They're used to being criticised. Every fiscal event, somebody hasn't got what they wanted and they complain about it. But there's no question that the allegations of Project Fear were definitely deeply felt. Then there was a period where Michael Gove's famous phrase, people are sick of experts.
I think the people in this country have had enough of experts with organisations from acronyms
saying... The people of this
saying,
country have had saying, enough of experts.
Some people felt in the Treasury that that was aimed at the Treasury. There was a period where the Permanent Secretary did a very good job of trying to reassure his staff. Don't be afraid to say what's in your heart and your mind, because if you are afraid, we won't have the information. Do your jobs with integrity and things will be okay. Leave the politics to the politicians and to people like me who were political appointees.
And it was high stakes because you were working on this Brexit deal that you were desperate to pass. You were seeing on your desk how potentially damaging to the economy no deal could be. You had to convince people to get a majority in this parliament, like Bill Cash and Bernard Jenkin. You needed them on your side to get the numbers, to get the votes passed. I mean, did you internally start to try and persuade them? Did you have briefings with them?
The Prime Minister's team worked very hard to keep everyone inside the tent. In truth, having the Treasury or any representative of the Treasury come in to try and convince some of the more hard Brexiteers wasn't going to necessarily be productive. So I think we focused our efforts where it could be of more use.
I mean, presumably your efforts could have been of use in persuading number 10. Wasn't it becoming increasingly clear at this stage that these guys weren't listening? They were attacking the Treasury. If you look at what they say now, it seems to me that they were never going to be satisfied with anything you could have possibly negotiated in deal terms. Why weren't you looking elsewhere in Parliament? Why weren't you trying to find a majority across the House?
That's a very easy assessment after the fact. And while you are still in conversation with the two sides, working on a compromise in the middle, you continue to think that you can bring people along with you. That's not to say your analysis is wrong. I think you're absolutely right that now looking back, it does look like an impossible task. But at the time, it was the one that we felt would bring the most people along with us and that we could find a way through, we could find a compromise.
As March 29th, 2019 came closer, it became more obvious that it was going to be extremely difficult to find that compromise.
Order!
Order!
The ayes to the right, 286. The noes to the left, 344.
Meaningful votes had been lost more than once, and people were talking about a cliff edge. At that point, were you putting in place emergency plans for no deal, or did you still think in your heart of hearts that this was not going to be allowed?
All I can say is that in the run-up to March 29th, there was an increasing preparation, increasing concern that that was a possibility, that we could face a cliff edge, and we weren't sure necessarily which direction the Prime Minister was going to have to go in. Those days, I remember being not particularly clear on what was going to happen the next day or the next day. And so certainly there was much more of a focus on it at that point, yeah.
It's interesting to look at what Philip Hammond has been saying since he stepped down, and particularly forcefully yesterday.
There is no mandate for leaving with no deal. It's absurd to suggest that the 52% of people that voted to leave the European Union all voted to leave with no deal, when in fact, during the referendum campaign, there was virtually no mention made by the leaders of that campaign at all of the possibility of leaving with no deal. And Michael,
he's argued that no deal is not acceptable, that it would damage the economy and even threaten the peace deal in Ireland and risk breaking up the UK. He's also made clear that Parliament will have its say, which led to Boris Johnson to say MPs are now collaborating with the EU.
There's a terrible kind of collaboration, as it were, going on between people who think they can block Brexit in Parliament and our European friends.
It seems to me that Hammond never really believed no deal was something that we could possibly accept, and that he didn't really take it seriously.
That's totally unfair. Half of what you said is right, the other half is not.
Tell me which half is right and the bit that's not.
He's been very clear, and I suspect he'll continue to be clear, that he believes no deal is bad for the economy and not responsible outcome. He believes it will be disruptive, and he's very vocal about that. But it's not right to say he didn't take it seriously. Of course he did.
And given how strongly you feel about that, since you left the Treasury after the March 29th deadline passed, you watched a Tory leadership race unfold.
3 years after the Brexit referendum, Britain is divided and deadlocked. Forced to resign as Tory leader, Theresa May's torrid time as Prime Minister is nearly over. But who is the man? And they are all men.
Which felt like it was a Brexit arms race at times. I mean, there was talk of proroguing Parliament.
What are your views on suspending Parliament?
Dominic Raab.
Well, we don't need to suspend Parliament. I think it's very unlikely.
Are you prepared to do it?
I've said it. I don't think it's likely, but it's not illegal.
So you are prepared to...
There was suggestion that they wouldn't even consider a time limit on the backstop. There was much more talk about no deal.
You do plan for no deal precisely because you want a deal. And we have to do that. And to take no deal off the table is a complete nonsense.
Jeremy Hunt.
I actually agree with everyone that we should, apart from Rory, that we should keep no deal on the table.
But it's not just talk now. Boris Johnson is Prime Minister and he's promising Brexit by any means necessary this October. Your former boss says that this government has now set its negotiating bar so high, it feels that no deal is inevitable. If that's where we end up, what happens in the Treasury on day one? What levers do they pull?
The one thing I know that the Treasury will be doing if we were to end up in a hard Brexit is they will be in immediate and constant contact with business, with financial services, with banks. They're very good at maintaining a grid of communication contact. It's fundamentally unprecedented, so we don't know exactly what it will look like. And there are a million and one hypothetical outcomes that you could imagine. The areas that I obviously focused on were financial services and banking and the economy. I think the sort of main effects for that remit are felt over the medium and longer terms. The lack of growth or the increased expense will be things that someone working in the Treasury today will be worried about if we were to leave with a hard exit. Whereas if you have a negotiated deal, you know what your rates are going to be, you know what your tariffs are or whether they're going to be there or not, and you can actually do the sums and do the planning. It's the not knowing, it's the uncertainty that for long-term economic planning or even short to medium-term economic planning is deeply unproductive.
It seems strange that the Conservative Party, which has always prided itself as being responsible with the economy, appears to be heading under Boris Johnson almost deliberately towards a no-deal Brexit. How do you feel about that?
I think first, it is too early to say. It is entirely possible that this is a strategy to encourage the EU to negotiate on a different type of deal that could be passed. I'm pretty clear from my position that I don't believe a no-deal option is a responsible one. I do understand that it is in many ways and for many people the only intellectually consistent option, but I remain hopeful that there is a third way. And if it's not Theresa May's deal, which is one thing I agree with him and his team on, it's obviously been rejected, this deal, and there needs to be a third way. And I remain hopeful that he will find a way to come back with a different deal that can be passed in Parliament. Because I don't believe that it is okay to sacrifice some people or some businesses or some households to short-term disruption, even if over the long or medium term we can improve our situation. And I absolutely don't dispute that that's possible. But I don't want to see a single household or business sacrificed to those ends.
What do you mean sacrifice? What do you fear?
Well, there will be... Look, I have a background in financial services and markets, and I covered the financial crisis and the crash. And I am not saying there is an immediate negative hit that we can measure that will be inflicted on people, households, families, businesses. But what I am saying is there is going to be a period of rank uncertainty and probably high volatility. And history tells us that volatility and uncertainty can often have negative economic impact. And that is what I don't want to see encouraged. I don't want us to increase any uncertainty that we may already be facing by making choices that exclude that third way, the possibility of some kind of agreement with the EU.
Poppy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Poppy Trowbridge, who has written a comment piece for The Guardian this week, warning against divisive language that pits the people against politicians. Have a read on the website. Coming up, how agriculture company Monsanto sought to discredit the work of a journalist. Carey Gillam has been covering the agrochemical industry in the US for more than two decades. Recently, she found out that Monsanto, a company that she has extensively reported on, had developed an action plan to discredit her work and reputation.
21 years ago, 1998, Reuters assigned me to move to Kansas and start writing about food and agriculture. I had been a banking reporter and thought that sounded like a horrible idea to traipse around farm fields and, you know, muddy boots and jeans. But I moved to Kansas and started learning everything I could about, you know, this industry. Monsanto had at the time just introduced genetically engineered seeds. They rolled those out in the mid-1990s, and it was revolutionizing agriculture. And it became clear, you know, after a few years of really diving into the beat, that the things that the company was saying about its products, about its herbicides and its genetically altered seeds, weren't really playing out on the ground the way that Monsanto was trying to present this to the world.
Roundup herbicide by Monsanto. There's never been a herbicide like it before.
Greenscape Weed Killer. Strong on weeds, gentle on the earth.
As my reporting began to lay out sort of the conflicts and the problems, the company became more and more agitated and more irritated with my coverage. They really wanted to control the narrative and control the way that I reported on their business. They couldn't really find factual errors with any of the stories that I was writing, so they started complaining about what they called false balance. They didn't want me quoting critics. They didn't want me quoting research that contradicted their claims that their herbicides were safe and not carcinogenic. You always get pushback from companies if they don't like the coverage. That's sort of normal and expected as a journalist. But never in my time, in my 30 years, have I ever experienced the tactics that Monsanto employed. What we've found out recently by obtaining some internal documents from the company is that they have a whole network and a deep, very dark strategy that the company has been employing for years to target individuals like myself, other journalists and scientists, to try to discredit and ruin a reputation. When my book came out in 2017, Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer and the Corruption of Science, Monsanto was ready. They had a spreadsheet with 20 different line items, and they employed a consulting company, and they were trying to buy up Google space so that when people searched for my name or my book or glyphosate, perhaps, they would get, you know, negative and slanderous information about me popping up on Google. They tried to arrange for third-party book reviews that would be very negative about my book and would look like they didn't have anything to do with Monsanto. A whole army of Twitter trolls that spend their time slandering me on social media. And I think, you know, it's been to some degree successful because there's doubt out there. Monsanto's desire is to create doubt and to silence and intimidate messengers who are trying to bring truthful information to light. You know, I am a middle-aged mother who works out of a little office, you know, off the corner of my kitchen in my house in Kansas. And the idea that this giant company was so focused on me, you know, seemed unbelievable to me until I saw the documents. Because if they would spend as much time and money and resources on me, certainly you can imagine that they have been engaged in much, much more in terms of trying to slander, you know, much, much bigger people than myself. Monsanto's efforts to discredit me, you know, have had an impact on my work, certainly. Anywhere that I, you know, publish an article now, they go after the editors of those publications. I know they have tried to pressure editors at The Guardian not to run my work. The Guardian has pretty much pushed back and held true to journalistic standards. I think told Monsanto to just go jump in the lake. We have moved into a place where powerful and wealthy corporations have far too much control and are dominating, you know, not only public policy, but public information now, controlling what we see and what we hear and what we know. And that's a very, very dangerous place to be. So I'm hoping that people will be more diligent and be more engaged and try to be more informed.
That was Carey Gillam. Do go to theguardian.com and have a read of her column. My thanks to her and to Poppy Trowbridge. We've had some lovely reviews recently, so I just wanted to thank anyone who has written one. They are hugely appreciated. Do keep them coming or do tweet me at Anushka Astana. Today's episode was produced by Josh Kelly and Gary Marshall. Thanks also to Oliver Taylor and Olivia Davies for their helpful research. Sound design was by Eloise Stevens. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.